Welcome to episode number 57 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it, and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. And I really need a new intro, because that's also not true of this episode. My name is Kelsey Liu, and I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
Our guest today is Jonas Rosland, executive director of HitSave, one of a tiny handful of organizations which, like our own Video Game History Foundation, is a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to games preservation. I wish there were 20 more. Jonas, welcome to the Video Game History Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, I mean, Kelsey was kind of alluding to this earlier, but normally our format is that we invite someone on who recently, you know, typically published some research, here to tell us a story. Once in a while, we like to take a little detour just to find out what's going on in the world of historical video game preservation. A good example comes to mind for me would be episode 26, where we talked to David Haywood, an emulation author, about the state of MAME and its history and where it's going. One of my favorite episodes, actually. Go check it out. Today, you know, I think it's just going to be kind of a casual conversation between two similar but also, you know, fairly different organizations. Jonas, this isn't like an interview, you know, like it's just conversation. And I say that because it's like you've not been shy about asking us questions in the past as well. And, you know, if you'd like to do that here, you know, feel free. This isn't an inquisition. on HitSave. Just to start us off, just put you on the spot. Give us the elevator pitch. What's HitSave?
Yeah, for sure. And you've been super helpful when I've had a bunch of questions on how to get started with the organization and other things as well. So, the short pitch of HitSave is that we're a nonprofit dedicated to the preservation of video games, their history, and related physical and digital materials. So we are working towards methodologies for scanning, preserving physical printed media, facilitate recorded interviews with people within the game development area, and also having a long-term strategy for preserving digital media.
So I think what's cool, just hearing all that and sort of brushing back up on what you've published already as HitSave, is that we're two organizations that preserve video game history, but there's some crossover, but really it's like there's so much to do.
There's tons.
Right. That like we're pretty distinct groups. You know, like the thing that comes to mind for me is that you know, you're doing things like, I mean, we'll just start here with like digital preservation standards and publishing them. It's something that, you know, we've talked about, but it's like realistically, we just don't focus on because we've got so much else going on here.
Yeah, we as we get started last year, so we just celebrated 1 year on October 14th.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So when we started last year, we wanted to publish something that one of our directors had been working on, Dustin Hubbard, who's been scanning a ton of stuff for video game preservation, scanning tons and tons of magazines and books and artwork and you name it. So he and many, many others within the community has come up with somewhat of an agreement of what should be done when it comes to scanning artifacts, scanning physical artifacts, scanning physical documents, and preserving them in a good way. So the first thing that we wanted to do is to put up a scanning guide. So we want our guides to be, they're not going to be the end-all, be-all guides for preservation, but it's a good starting point. And so it's a way for people to understand the methodologies that we use. And it's a way for people to get into preservation if they're interested in helping out somehow. So if someone wants to scan a document or scan a magazine, how do I do that? Well, you head over to scanning.guide. This is our recommended way of doing things. So that's what we wanted to do. We want to set in place some standards. There are so many standards out there. So of course we're reusing a ton. We're not setting new things in place, but rather looking at what are people already doing and then documenting that in central places so people can easily find them.
Right. Because, I mean, you really can't rely on just one person or one organization to figure absolutely everything out and to get everything scanned, quite frankly. I mean, we have we've sent and purchased a ton of magazines to the exact guy that you're talking about, to Dustin Hubbard, who runs Gaming Alexandria. And he does a fantastic job, but he's just one guy. And I think that it's a very important niche to fill to sort of empower other people to be like, hey, maybe you're not going to do a perfect job, but I mean, as a historian, it's like, if it's readable, you've already put it in so many more hands and given it so much more life than it had before that. So even if you're scanning it poorly or not up to, you know, perfect standards, I think it's, yeah, the ability to empower people to do some of this themselves is huge.
Yeah, just having something instead of nothing. Something that we can share, something that we can look at is very important. One example, Norm, the gaming historian, actually added a segment on the scanning guide for how he did quick scanning at a library where he didn't have access to a scanning. So he used just a mobile app tool for that called Tiny Scanner. And we added that to the guide because he wrote up a whole like, hey, here's how I did it. And it's like, yeah, that's perfect. As long as we have something. It's not perfect. No. But it's, as you said, Kelsey, it's readable so people, other people can use it. And it's super useful for reference material where you can't share that or take it out of the library.
That does my heart good to know that the app that I've used like 6 years ago is still the app for on-site quick scanning at a library or something.
It's an app, yes.
Yeah. For sure. Well, it's Norm's app, so it's my app because
it's in the guide. So
it's in the guide. On scanning.guide. But you know, it's coming up with these standards is something that. You know, there is no such thing as a standard, especially when we're talking about a digital representation of a physical object, right? Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as a perfect scan. And
it will always be an approximation.
Exactly. And, yeah. Let's just get Dustin on here to talk about that, actually. he's overdue. We'll have an hour talk about halftone screening.
I think that would be fantastic.
I think so, too. We'll do it. I think right away, you know, that's what differentiates something like a HitSave from us, which is that we're a lot more concerned with gathering material that's falling through the cracks and just building sort of a safe place for them to exist and figuring out both physical and digital access on our own with our own collection, whereas HitSave is much more, I mean, almost entirely, I would say most of what you do is focused on empowerment of the community to do the work, something that frankly, and we recognize this, we're very bad at the Video Game History Foundation.
Yeah, I definitely think you hit it right on the spot there. We want to empower the community. It's what we want to do. We really want to empower the community. We have a fantastic community around preservation, around video game history, and we want to empower them. So one way to do this is, of course, to have the guides. Another way is to also help people do interviews with game developers. We've done a bunch of interviews throughout the past year, which has been super fun, and we want to empower others to do this as well. So helping out with making sure that they have the right contacts, making sure that they have the right equipment. Maybe we can help out with hardware. Maybe you need a proper mic so you can do a proper interview. Things like that. So empowering the community, because we absolutely recognize that we can't do everything ourselves. The community has been fantastic in many decades before we were even formed. So we're just happy to be a part of the community, be a part of the preservation and the history community. And yeah, we're just trying to help as much as possible.
So, I mean, on your website and in your mission statement and stuff, the thing that I always kind of latched on to as being a little different from what other people are doing is you say you're focused on driving and assisting preservation efforts worldwide. So it's very much, I mean, and obviously explain more if I'm wrong, but the feeling that I always got from your organization was like, does someone have a project that needs some help? And what can we do to help? And, you know, here we've done some of that ourselves. We've paid for, you know, if people need something scanned or we've done that, I think, to a degree. But I don't know that that's something that we advertise very much. And I don't know that that's like the niche that we fill in the world. And I feel like a lot of what HitSave does well, I want to talk about one of the things that you guys did kind of recently, which was the e-reader stuff. I mean, that was like someone else's project that came to you and needed some help, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the e-reader crew, as they call themselves, they've been very, very specific when it comes to scanning e-reader cards and related material around the e-reader cards. They have created their own methods of scanning really high quality to make sure that they gather all the dot codes of the e-reader cards so we can actually see the dot codes. If you don't have a good enough scanner and you don't scan at a good enough resolution, you can't actually see them, so you can't see the data that is on the e-reader cards. So
real quick, just to define e-reader cards for some people real quick, it is a Game Boy Advance accessory that reads literal cards, like trading cards, and the data on these cards, you swipe it through basically like a little barcode reader. The data on these cards is stored in an array of teeny tiny dots. So scanning these well, if we're talking about like reproducing the data on these cards, it's actually incredibly important that they're well scanned, because that's the only way that the real data, the real code on these things can be read.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. I definitely want to make sure that people have the context. So, what they did, they even created their own plexiglass, not cases, not molds, but templates, custom cut, essentially, where they place the card into the plexiglass. So it's always oriented the same way when they do scanning for all the cards to make sure it's not wonky at all. So they definitely went many steps beyond normal scanning of artifacts like this. So they came to us early this year, just a few months after we started, and said, hey, we would love to see if we can work something out. And we're like, yeah, that sounds like a fantastic project. We would love to help you out. So we did a few live streams, and we did a fundraiser, and we were able to raise funds for their project and for their scanning and just refining the methods and building out really advanced 3D prints that were used to scan dot codes off of e-reader cards that were encased in grading cases and things like that. So yeah, they did a ton of trial and error, and we were just super, super happy to see them succeed in their project there.
And it brought a bunch of like additional awareness, I think, to that project too, because I mean, I'm familiar with the e-reader cards. I was familiar with the fact that some of them were incredibly rare. There was that like E3 Kirby one that was thought to be lost forever, kind of thing. But you know, that's all I knew, was it was like, oh, maybe someone's working on that. So I think another benefit of that is just being able to expose that project to more people, and I don't know, you can all kind of rest easy knowing that that's actually going pretty well.
Yeah, we definitely want to empower others. Another project that we're helping out with is the Aru project, an open source project. So I'm part of the technical committee together with other people from the Game Preservation Society and Cinematech Swiss. So helping out with direction and requests, essentially, for features within Aru, which is a fantastic tool for dumping discs, both magnetic discs, CDs, DVDs, you name it.
And yeah, so yeah, that's
helping out there too.
Natalia Portillo's project, right?
Correct.
Who's your CTO at HitSave. And
yep.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's a, I've used it a couple times. It's a command line tool for, I mean, I believe her, I mean, this is another one where it's like, oh, maybe we should have her on, but, but it's a tool essentially for, archival digitization. And she is someone, she is the person I go to, you know, if I don't understand, something about the physical quirks of optical media, right? So
same.
You know, Natalia has helped us at the foundation to digitize some problematic discs, and her tools are great for that. But you know, we mentioned the scanning guide. Maybe this is a little more forward thinking than it is at its current state to talk about, but you know, you also at HitSave have ambition to essentially be the dumping guide, right? Like the digitization guide of game related media.
Yeah, so we actually published that on our 1 year anniversary, so October 14th. So that's almost 2 weeks ago. So dumping.guide is now live with a bunch of guides for various different systems, both cart-based systems and disk-based systems, and there are tons of others. And again, we don't aim to be the end-all be-all there either. There have been tons of great guides already written. What we want to do is to help others find that great material. So I don't want to rewrite a fantastic guide that someone else has already written. We'll link to it. We'll make sure that we have an archive of it. So and give them the credit. It's very important that we give the right people credit for the work that they have done for decades already. So we're all about that. So within dumping.guide, there are a few guides that I have written myself. There are a few guides that others within the community has written themselves as well. And then we also link out to other reference material. So yeah, that's what we want. There are tons of systems out there that I have no idea how to dump. So we're researching and we're asking people who know about it, and maybe they need to translate it from a different language. If it's a different system that was only available over in Japan or over in France or over somewhere else, maybe we need to translate instructions. So yeah, helping out with that and building out the dumping guide is something that I'm super, super excited about.
It is important too, because there's a lot of arcane knowledge when it comes to digitizing some of these systems, and it's sometimes it's very easy, sometimes it's fairly complicated. The NES, I think, is a little bit notorious for being pretty complicated to digitize cartridges of, or you know, it's also a lot of very custom hardware and software. Kelsey, you and I recently learned the Atari Mex, which is, as far as we know, it's a guy, right, who's making equipment.
Well, he sends a little printed piece of paper with his contact information on it with the Atari Mex. So it is literally one guy.
Yeah, and I think I got like a piece of candy or something last time. Like, it's a guy. But, you know, I believe that the Atari Mex hardware is the only off-the-shelf product for digitizing, you know, most of the Atari cartridges, including the 8-bit computer. Definitely the only product, I'm sure, for things like the Leisure Vision, which I think that's the same as the Arcadia. I don't even know. It's just one of those old 80s things. And I guess my point is that, like, you know, these aren't like other formats. There's not, for film, for example, there's a lot of standardized film formats, and in most major cities, at least, there are labs that can, even if it's hard, you know, digitize a U-matic tape or whatever, right? Like they can, and these are decks that are dying as well, but like there's at least resources to go to right now. When it comes to things like Atari games, it's like, it's actually very complicated. And, you know, I think, well, okay, let's just, I'll put this to you then, Jonas. You know, most video games, like retail video games, we're pretty sure there's clean copies of online at this point. There's exceptions, but what is it that you're hoping to see by getting these instructions out there? Are we hoping to surface, you know, for example, Nier before their passing was able to demonstrate that like a lot of our PAL Super Nintendo games were bad dumps that we assumed were good for years until he went, you know, is that sort of the hope? Is that why you're putting this information out there?
Yeah, we definitely want more people involved. If we have one copy, one dump made of a specific game, then we have to trust that that's a good dump. But we don't know unless more people with other tools are doing the same thing and are getting the same result. So if we have three or four people using three or four different tools and three or four different methodologies, and they still arrive at the same dump, then it's good. That's perfect. That's cool. So we definitely want to enable the preservation community there to and get more people in. As we are all getting older, some people might want to leave the preservation community. And we definitely need more people to join in on the community. And decades to come, if someone finds a rare copy of a game, we want to make sure that we have instructions to dump that to. So it's just forward thinking. We want to make sure that we have these instructions stored somewhere. They might not be used right now because we already have many of the games preserved. But someone new might come in and say, hey, I have this Super Nintendo game that I would like to do a 14th dump of. How do I do that? And of course, we want to welcome that. So then we can just point to, hey, go to dumping.guide. Here are the tools that you need. Here are the purchase links, non-affiliate. Here are the purchase links. And go buy the thing and do the thing and then report back. So we want to enable the preservation community, have a simple way for them to find the information they need.
I definitely asked this before you pulled the trigger and launched HitSave. I'm going to ask you again, what does being a 501c3 actually get you?
That's a really good question. We get a lot of red tape.
Kelsey, thanks for running payroll today, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome. I have to call the state of California to figure out that weird like $50 thing. Never mind, this isn't interesting. Point is, there's a lot of red tape.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of red tape, and there are definitely some misconceptions within the community that if you're an established nonprofit, rules do not apply. And it couldn't be further from the truth.
It is the exact opposite.
Exactly. So as an official organization, we of course have to abide by intellectual property laws and all of that. So what it gives us is a way to gather a great group of people and help them out with their preservation efforts and also their history efforts. So when it comes to preservation, there are already a slew of fantastic organizations out there. The Video Game History Foundation, of course, and then loose-knit organizations like VGPC, and then, of course, Game Preservation Society over in Japan. They're doing preservation of video games. So there are already tons of organizations out there. So what we've seen in the past year is that we can help out in another way. So we've really started taking our history or gathering history around indie games to a new level. Because we are interviewing indie game developers and gathering their history. So asking them about their process when it came to developing a game, the history behind the idea of the game, the release of the game, and so on. So capturing that history as it happens for some of them. Some of them are fairly new, so we're gathering information there. And we're also then taking a lot of their information. Just a few weeks ago, we published a blog post about the Wintermore Tactics Club. Where we also shared a lot of their public design documents. So we shared them in public because they gave us the permission to do so, and we're able to do so as a proper organization that store them for perpetuity.
So is it a trust thing primarily? Yes. In that case?
Definitely. I mean, a trust.
I can tell you just from personal experience, you know, reaching out to someone as a historian versus reaching out to them on behalf of a nonprofit, you tend to get a little bit better results with the latter. But I think it's like with a certain kind of person. There's a certain kind of person that requires that sort of officialness, mm-hmm, to trust you. And I mean, if that's what it takes to get people to open up about development and be able to share that with a broader swath of the world, I mean, I think that's great.
Yeah. So for us, I would say we're more about the history aspect right now than the preservation aspect. We're not about building up a library. We don't have the manpower or the money to build out a library. And others like you are already doing that. So
We don't have the money either, but we're doing it.
So, yeah, what we are focusing on is definitely capturing the history right now. So capturing the history, helping other historians, and helping other groups with their preservation efforts instead of us doing the preservation itself. So that's kind of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, I'm thinking about why we're a 501c3. You know, I think I might have even told you, Jonas, don't bother because it'll limit you. I was given and ignored the same exact advice from someone else who ran a 501c3. For us, it was a couple things. It was the need to elevate the work to be taken seriously. It's not, you know, just like a Discord group or a forum or whatever. It's like, no, it's language that old men understand, right? This is a charity. And then also, frankly, it was just like, there are things that can only be solved with money. And we felt that being able to raise money toward the projects that need money, you know, like would propel things forward. And, you know, it is a necessity. And in both of our cases, yeah, that does limit us. I mean, we can't throw, you know, we can't be like Forest of Illusion or whatever, right? We can't just throw anything online that we find and go, here it is.
That would be fantastic if we could, but yeah, no, unfortunately not.
Yeah, so I mean that's a kind of from our perspective, but I want to go back to this notion of, you know, interviewing. A lot of what you do, and this is I believe led by Amanda, one of your team members, right?
Yep. Amanda Farrow.
Yeah,
who's our director of communications.
So she has a journalism background, and. You know, it seems like she's kind of applying that, you know, applying her existing skills to your organization. And what you're doing is something that I think a lot of people want to see in the world, and even might even presume that we do some of, right? Which is that let's capture history as it's happening. You know, it's not history yet, but it is soon. And, you know, it's typically when we talk about that, in terms of like, oh, maybe we should be capturing online experiences, but it's like, well, no, we should be capturing, like, you know, so how often in Kelsey, how often in your research was it was the key that like some random ass newspaper talked to the guy.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, finding even single quotes from people, sometimes, first of all, is the only reason I know someone's name.
Yep.
Because crediting has historically been very terrible in video games. And it's, you know, it's better these days, but we still have struggles with that. I think that the ability to have those things now before we wish that someone would have done them basically it's a very big deal.
Yeah, it's been super fun. We've interviewed a bunch of indie game developers throughout the year, and yeah, just letting them know that we want to save their history, save their story, their personal stories about how they became involved with the game industry before in a decade or two when they're super famous. So we want to capture that right now, talk to them right now about the game that they worked on, that they poured their heart and soul into.
That's a thing that we've discussed sometimes too. I mean, you said before they're super famous, and you know, that's one of the reasons why when we go to events, we try to just grab as much of the event as we can. So any like flyers, any business cards, paperwork, take some photos, all of that stuff. Because you just never know who's going to be the next Shigeru Miyamoto, you know? And it's like, what if their first showcase was here on the sixth floor of PAX West, you know, 2018 or whatever, and they were just some guy showing off an indie game, and then later on they go on to be something of a legend, right? So you can't, it's not for us to judge in the present whether or not that's a possibility. You just kind of have to prepare for that as much as you can. Which brings me to a question I have, because this is actually something that we struggle with sometimes. Because you've started doing this with a lot of indie studios, have you run into a situation yet where you're like, there's too many people, we don't have enough manpower to do all of the interviews and you know, capture the entire story of everyone who is ready to be captured?
I would say yes. There are so many indie game developers out there. There are tons and tons of them. We can't capture every story out there, but we're trying to capture stories that we find interesting, of games that have been released, and games that have gotten at least some notoriety. Is that the right
word? Notoriety.
Thank you. Non-English native speaker here. So we look at the games that we find interesting as well. So it's a bit subjective in that manner, but we also need to take care of our own time. So I work a full-time job and have a family, and Amanda, same thing. She has a big family that she takes care of too. So trying to schedule these interviews when it works, between our work and other life, definitely is challenging sometimes. So we've had other people reach out and say, hey, we would love to be a part of this. So we're hoping within the next year that we can kind of build out a roster of people who would like to do these interviews within the organization. So that's definitely something that we want to do.
That goes back to that empowering thing.
Exactly. It's all about that. And we want to help the community capture the history of all these fantastic video games.
Yeah, and it almost strikes me as, you know, I mean, let's face it, you're a severely underfunded organization. There's not a lot of there's not a lot coming in to your Patreon. Let's change that, by the way, dear listeners. Go to what was the address? We'll plug it again at the end, but where's that Patreon?
patreon.com/hitsave.
Okay, pause this podcast, go do that, come back. You know, you're not, it strikes me that you're not really building long-term sustainability with money. You're building it more with like knowledge share, right? Like it's almost like HitSave is not, you know, an entity, it's a concept, right? Like, and it's, and it's, I mean, this is getting a little I guess we're already hitting the philosophical, you know, last 10 minutes of the show, 25 minutes early, but, you know, it's almost like what you're building. When I think about our sustainability and long-term, and let's be clear, like we're here long-term, Kelsey and I do this till we die.
I'll go back to doing this for free if I have to. And I think you will too.
Yeah. We cut our hands and bled on each other. No, we didn't. But basically a blood
when
pact.
When was that? I was not awake.
And, you know, the point being that like most of what we do is like try to build the money bedrock, essentially, to make sure that our physical archive and our work and our visions of the future are like funded. But it almost seems like you're working around that, and the bedrock that you're building is more just making sure that you know, thousands of people can do this work on their own without needing someone to police it.
That would be fantastic. I would be happy if we had three more. 1,000 would be a little unmanageable, but yeah, if we had a few more, that would be fantastic. We're, as I said before, we're not going to build out a library. We do have physical artifacts. We have a lot of physical artifacts that we are storing, of course, and because most of us are collectors to start with, and then we start from that collection, and then we look at, okay, what would actually make sense to hand over to the nonprofit? And I know you did this as well, Frank.
We still do.
So, yeah. And I think that's a really good way to start. But again, we're not going to build out a humongous library. Maybe we'll send things over to you because you have more resources. You have that financial bedrock in building out that physical preservation aspect of things. So we're more about the process itself, for sure. Making sure that people understand the processes of preserving video games. Not just preserving video games, but one of the things that we'll be working on, and this is kind of a pre-announcement, but another thing that we'll be working on is preservation.guide, where we are looking at how do we actually preserve the physical artifacts as well. So how do we clean things? How do we make sure that a CD works today and just as well as it worked 10 years ago? So making sure that we preserve the artifacts in a proper manner as well, because there are so many different thoughts on how to properly store items. So we want to just give people a heads up, like, don't store them in your garage over the
winter.
Don't
live in Florida.
Yeah, exactly. beware of humidity, things like that. I know
cool,
you
dry
also...
place applies to anything, you know, like it's food, it's Nintendo games.
Remove staples from manuals. Just basic things like that. To make sure that we can have these items for a long time. So enabling the preservation community out there, enabling the collectors out there to preserve their video games for the future. Not for us to host their video games for them in a library somewhere, but for them to take care of their own collection and to help out the rest of the video game preservation community that way. And then, of course, with the interviews, so capturing history as we do it right now. So processes, history, that's more of what we are doing. Absolutely. We're not building out. As you said, that financial bedrock would be super nice to have. So please head over to our Patreon. but yeah, we're all about making sure that we enable others.
And I want to expand on that a little bit because, and this is something, you know, I won't be shy to say that we struggle with some of these things too. It's, I feel like there are a lot of people who want to help with the notion of saving video game history and game preservation. And it's very noble, but it can be difficult, I think, very quickly to start figuring out how to manage people who you don't necessarily know their, commitment towards it. I think there are like just thousands of people who would love to do like an hour a week, but it's difficult to justify, you know, training someone up for 1 hour a week, maybe, when there's like 1,000 of them, you know? So how do you deal with finding people, like, I mean, training people who might want to get involved, or finding people who want to do this a little bit more seriously than, you know, I mean, I think casual interest, just to clarify, casual interest is also very good, but how do you either move people from casual to semi-serious, or find people who are semi-serious?
So I lean back on my experience within the open source communities. So as my day job, I'm an open source community manager, and I also lead a team of other open source community managers. So we see this every day, where people come into our open source projects or projects that we are helping out with and say, hey, I would like to help. And it's like, okay, here are a few things that we have prepared that we need help with. So we start preparing for that and say, these are usually low-hanging fruit. Within open source projects, they're called good first issues. So it could be low-hanging fruit. It might be that we need to change some documentation, for instance. Or it might be a tiny, not really a bug or an error, but maybe we're not logging something correctly. Here's something you can do if you want to dive into the code as well. So we work with the team. So this is for my real job. As an open source community manager, we work with the maintainer team and identify some of these low-hanging fruits so we can get people involved. One thing that we did recently for a project that I worked with, the Contour project, a Cloud Native Computing Foundation project, was that we started a technical writing working group where we invited a bunch of people from everywhere. We got 15 people join in from Reddit, from Twitter, from Slack, and they joined in our session. And we said, hey, here's what we need to do. And out of those 15, we got three that continued to come back. They wanted to help us. They wanted to invest time in this. So that's kind of the same methodology we use for building out the community around HitSafe, where we see, okay, here are the people that are continuing to come back with either good content or good comments or good questions. And those are the individuals that we want to work more closely with. So that's how we kind of grow that community, because we know that a lot of people want to help out. So we look at, okay, what do we need right now? So the guides are a good example. We have a fantastic member of the community, L. Doug. He's doing a bunch of cleaning videos for video games and consoles and things like that. So he said, that's perfect. Maybe you can help write things for the preservation guide. So involving the community that way.
Yeah, I think that's really good way to go about it, is just trying to finding the people who seem serious already. And like I said, it's something that we struggle with, and it's mostly just out of a manpower need. But there are a lot of people who want to do good in this space. And I think there is a lot of good to do, even if it's not, you know, working specifically with an organization. I think there's just, like we mentioned earlier, there's so much that needs to be done. Everything from, you know, there's some very simple things like transcribing and scanning and stuff. And then there's some, like, I don't know, are you incredibly technically inclined? Do you want to try to figure out Casio Loopy emulation? Because that's not done yet. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so we've had two other community members that have helped out throughout the year. We had one who reached out and said, hey, I'm a researcher. I'm not involved in video game preservation or video game history. How can I help? And after a few emails back and forth, we settled on, hey, we got an interview coming up with an indie game developer. Can you please give us some more information about their background? Because you're a researcher. And they did. They came back with a really long list of fantastic background and links to articles and things like that that they have been that they had been involved in before. So that was fantastic. So that was one way that we got help from the community. Another one is a member of the Discord community who has been helping out with our transcriptions. So with our interviews, we also do an automated transcription, and it's okay, I would say.
Yeah. Wait, okay, that sounds like Otter.
Yeah, that's Otter.
That's what we use as well.
Yeah, so it's okay, but it gets so much wrong at the same time. So we definitely need help to go through this whole long transcript of what was actually said. When we mentioned a name of a video game or a name of a person, we want to make sure that it says that name and not cactus or whatever. Yeah, just helping out that way is a way you can help out with preserving history, preserving the history around video games.
And I think transcripts are so important too, and often maybe underlooked, because what a transcript does, I mean, an interview is fantastic. What a transcript does is allows you to like Google search for it easily and text search for things. And as a researcher who may not know that an interview happened in the first place, it just kind of gives you a better avenue for surfacing that.
Yeah. Yeah. We put a lot of our transcripts up on GitHub. So they're under github.com/hitsave. So anyone can go in there, and by putting them on GitHub as well, other people can actually help out in editing them and help with making them better, which we've had a few times. So super, super thankful for that, because it takes a long time to go through the transcription and fix everything that's wrong.
So you're 1 year old, not you. The hit save.
He's 1 year old. I turned 40 this year.
I turned 40 next year, baby. For me, with the foundation, I've always said it's malleable, like from day negative 40. You know, like before we launched, it was like, whatever this is, it's like we need to morph and evolve and. You know, my point is that every year consistently, you know, by the end of the year, the Video Game History Foundation, at least my headcanon version of it, and I'd like to think that's canon, it changes every year. We are not the same. We don't have the same. The core is the same, but like the sort of day to day and like the where we're going, the details change every year at least. And I'm just wondering, after 1 year, like, is HitSave what it was when you started, or have you evolved it into being something else?
It definitely changed, I would say. So when we started, we wanted to preserve as much as possible. But again, that being an underfunded organization, we can't preserve everything. So we looked at, okay, how can we help with other preservation efforts that are already ongoing throughout the globe? Okay, so scanning.guide, okay, one. Dumping.guide, okay, perfect. Then the e-reader crew came and we did a fundraiser for them, perfect. We're helping others do things. So by changing our focus from us doing a lot of preservation to building out the community and helping the community do the preservation work, that definitely changed the organization a bit. It was always what we wanted to do, but I didn't think it would happen that quickly. And then we launched the indie game preservation project pretty quickly as well, because that was something that we only thought of before we launched. And then a few months in, we said, you know what, this is really important. Let's do that. So we really focused on that this year, and it's been super, super fun. And we got several interviews lined up for the rest of the year.
And I found that a lot of the early ideas that I pushed aside weren't forever. It was just like, okay, this is a waiting, I didn't know this at the time necessarily, but it's like, we just don't have what's needed yet for this. And you know, one example of that is, it's happening right now, which is that, something I wanted at the start of the foundation was to shine a brighter light on what preservation is and what everyone's doing. I might have even, you know, I don't think of myself this way at all anymore. I think I was pretty naive, but I thought like we could sort of be the hub so that everyone knows what's going on, right? Because to my mind, most people that do the work don't do a very good job of promoting the work that they do.
100%.
So, you know, I'm not saying that we've come back around to that early idea completely, but, you know, this show is an example of like, okay, let's, you know, it's not an idea that's dead. It's just like, we didn't really have the proper place for it yet. And I don't know, I suspect that's probably going to happen with a lot of the things that fell behind for you guys, maybe even doing the direct, you know, the preservation part of it, right? The digitization part of it. I mean, you've got Hubs on your team. He's not going to stop doing that.
No. So
that's all he wants to do. He just wants to scan all day.
For sure. So from a personal point of view, of course, we continue with preservation work and the preservation that work that we have been doing for years. But as an organization, we don't do a lot of preservation work ourselves. Yeah, so we kind of distinguish between the person involved and the organization involved. But as a person, of course, we do a lot of preservation work.
Well, okay, so we're a year in now, and I mean, I sort of hate it when people ask me this question because there's so many ways that our organization can evolve, but I still want to ask you, like, in 5 or 6 years, like, you don't have to give me your 5-year plan, but like, what is your hope that this evolves into over time?
I think it goes back to what we talked about before. In 5 years, I hope that we have enabled more people to do preservation work and capture the history of video game developers. That's my genuine hope, for us to enable others, making sure that they are successful in their role within the preservation community. I want to enable them and put them forward and essentially help them make a name for themselves if they are not already known to the public. So that's what I want to do. I myself, Jonas here, I don't need to be in the limelight. I'm happy to stay behind and help others. So I'm always trying to push others to do their very best and be recognized for the hard work that they do. So that's what we want to do with the organization. We want to enable others to participate in the preservation and history community. And if we have done that within the next 5 years, then I would say we're successful.
Yeah, it's just making me think of mostly you, Kelsey, actually. Like it's I'm not a spotlight guy either. But something that we've begrudgingly, I don't know if that's too strong of a word, but like a lot of what we do is try to be splashy and bombastic because we just feel that we need to shake, like grab the world by the shoulders and shake them when it comes to this stuff.
But I love that. I love that though, because you have a fantastic audience for that. I think it's great what you do when you're being bombastic and you have really strong feelings about things, and you tweet about them, and you blog and write fantastic articles.
Well, thanks, and that's mostly what I was thinking about, right? And yeah, and Kelsey, I mean,
great.
I don't know, I don't think this is necessarily a secret, and I'm sorry if it is and I'm exposing you, but you know, your YouTube channel was done because that's just how you could get people to pay attention to it, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you may have noticed I haven't uploaded a YouTube video in several years. It's because I don't actually like doing YouTube. I hate video editing. I'm okay in front of a camera, but nothing special. And I'm, you know, like Frank said, I'm not like much of a limelight person. But I found that a very effective way to teach, especially just in the current era, this hasn't always been the case, but right now, like that seems to be a very effective way to reach people and to teach them about things that they maybe hadn't really thought about before. And, you know, when I was doing my channel, I tended to focus on what I considered to be kind of smaller, or even sometimes, you know, things that might have been made fun of even to a degree, things like the Game Boy sewing machine or the Super Nintendo exercise bike, and show like, these weren't a joke. Like, this is a real product that there was real thought and business plan and stuff behind. It's not like a punchline. Yeah, I mean, all of that just to say, like, the way to get this stuff out there, the way to get people to care, sometimes, unfortunately, involves doing a little bit of the, like, shaking and yelling and jumping around.
For sure. I've been in marketing and other spotlight roles for a long time, and I'm happy with that. I'm happy to be on stage. That's perfectly okay. I actually love being on stage, but I don't have to be on stage all the time. That's the main point. I'm right. Happy to be on stage, but there are so many others out there that have not been on stage yet, and I want to make sure that they get there.
Yeah, and I think our, when I say we, the content that we, I love our content, but it's like we spend a lot of time on our content, and the reason that we do it is because we're trying to, Kelsey and I are just very impatient people, I would say, and we both want to see what we would perceive of as a better tomorrow, which is that people are able to access source material that they couldn't before to, like, tell good video game history instead of, you know, traditional sort of citing the crumbs that we have on Wikipedia sort of video game history. And the content is really just, you know, maybe it's shaking shoulders, but Simon Carlos on our board once called it stoking the market. And that's how I think of it mostly, which is just like, no, look, you can be doing it like this. You know, like if we think that all that's missing is that you can't get at these things because they're all over the place and no one's really put them in one place before. But if we all have access to this material, we can do cool stuff like this, all of us together. Everyone can be a video game historian. And
I love that.
And you know, that's why we sort of, you know, that's why we spend all this time and energy on the content, which isn't super frequent, but it's,
but when we do it, it's
right.
A lot of...
And I don't know, it feels distracting, but it's all part of the cause. And, I don't know where I'm going with this other than thank you for being our therapist, Jonas.
Well, I mean...
You're welcome. Kelsey, I got to say that the sewing machine episode that you did, though, I love that one.
Oh, thank you.
It was really cool, and I learned a lot. So thank you.
And that was, you know, when I came to Frank, and I use this phrase fairly often, I was like, I was a frustrated historian because I was doing videos like that, and... finding that it took me just an incredibly stupid amount of time to find crumbs of primary sources. And, you know, when you're talking about like a sewing machine thing, no one wants to talk to you. No one was going to take an interview about the Game Boy sewing machine. I tried. so you really are just working with the crumbs that sort of made it onto, you know, I was using like the university databases and that sort of thing, whatever just kind of newspapers and press releases had maybe been scraped and picked up by that. But it really is, it's crumbs. But yeah, I mean, to go back to what Frank said, and I think to tie it even back to what HitSave is doing, I mean, that stoking the market thing, we really do want to empower other people to be good video game historians and researchers, because, you know, I used to be frustrated when I would see an error in something. You know, there, like, famously there was a Jeopardy question that was just complete BS about Tetris. Yeah. And you know, they're like, there's just a lot of like little things that kind of have become the canon because they just get repeated so often. But what I finally came around to, and Frank, I think too, is just like, people maybe are bad researchers, but it's not their fault. Like, it's no one's fault that this stuff is hard to find right now, yeah. And it's hard to do the research. And so it's not that they're like bad researchers necessarily. It's that they don't have the tools. And I mean, that's the thing that we want to fix, because we want people to be better at it in the future.
I love that. I love that. I'm super excited to see what you all are doing in 5 years.
I'm scared. I appreciate that. But I mean, you know, I think really what you're doing is very similar to that philosophy. You know, it's just like, no, it's all we have is us, right? And it's like, we all are in this together. We need to figure this out together. There's no, you know, official video game preservation, like government that's going to solve the problems. It's just like, it's just a bunch of people working together, trying to fix all this. We just need better tools and better communication to get there.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I'm looking at something like the movie preservation industry. It's the same thing there. I mean, it's global. We have movies and TV shows globally. We have video games globally. It doesn't work if it's only a few people trying to do the preservation and the history of all of it. It takes a whole community, for sure. So you all collecting all the information so researchers can actually find the right information is critical. And then if we can enable them somehow else, that would be super nice too. But yeah, what you're doing is fantastic.
Thank you. What you're doing is fantastic. Thank you. Let's just end there on that little
that exchange. Adorable note.
Yeah. Jonas, this is awesome. Thanks for joining us. We're going to link to HitSave's website, Patreon, et cetera, in the show notes. But for those listening, not reading, where can people find you, including that Patreon URL, again, for those who didn't pause and go give?
Yeah, so you can find all the links over at hitsave.org. And if you want to head over to patreon.com/hitsave and join us there, that would be fantastic. If you want to check out our Twitter account, which isn't as prolific as the Video Game History Foundation, but it's over at twitter.com/hitsaveorg. And then we also have our GitHub, where we have our interview transcripts over at github.com/hitsave. And you can always find me on Twitter at Jonas Rosland. My DMs are open if you want to ask me anything.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jonas. This was awesome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunamune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.